Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Dr. Ed Chu. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu's Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact Dr. Chu directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed is joined by Dr. Jonathan Nisley. Dr. Nisley is the co-director of the Yale New Haven Gamma Knife Center and an associate professor of therapeutic radiology.
So why don't we start off? The topic for tonight's discussion is brain cancer. So maybe you can give us kind of a broad general definition of what brain cancer is.
Well, brain cancer, colloquially speaking, is cancer that involves the brain. And clearly, just as we can talk about cancers arising within the brain or cancers arising elsewhere and spreading to the brain, we need to be clear about the differences between those types of tumors. And obviously, as we're talking about brain tumors, you can have primary brain tumors that are infiltrative and very difficult to treat, and you can have brain tumors that are sort of near the surface of the brain and much more readily treated.
I guess we'll probably primarily focus on tumors that really arise from within the brain, and I gather there are a whole number of different types of brain tumors, brain cancers.
That's right, Ed. The most common type of brain tumor is called a glioma, and glioma tumors arise from the support cells of the brain, not actually from the neurons themselves, but from the cells that help support the brain's activity. And there are a number of different types of tumors that are all fall under the classification of glioma: astrocytoma, oligodendroglioma, ependymoma. You can have mixes of those three types of tumors. And probably the most common type of primary brain tumor that we see in adults is glioblastoma multiforme.
And just to give our listeners a sense, about how many new cases of, say, the last type, glioblastoma multiforme, would you say are diagnosed, you know, each year in the United States? Is it common relative to some of the other cancers like breast cancer, prostate cancer, colorectal cancer?
No, it's not common relative to some of the other cancers. Obviously, carcinomas arising from bronchi, breast cancer, and bowel cancer are the big killers, the killer bees. But brain cancer is a big killer as well, in part because we've had such difficulty in getting good control of brain tumors. The number of brain tumors that arise each year, probably, about 7 per 100,000.
Okay. Is the most common age in which brain cancers would be diagnosed?
Most commonly seen in people between the ages of about 50 and 70. I think that as we have improvements in just general health, people not dying of cardiovascular, hypertension-related problems, diabetes better controlled, they're living longer and brain tumors are becoming more frequent.
Now, it's interesting. Obviously, brain cancer has received a great deal of attention recently with Teddy Kennedy's diagnosis of brain cancer. And do you know what specific type of brain cancer Senator Kennedy has?
What I know is from the news media, and it's been reported that he has a glioblastoma multiforme.
And what would be the main risk factors for someone developing brain cancer?
I think the most common risk factor for most people is bad luck, but there are some things that have been shown to be associated with brain cancer. A history of having had radiation in the past. There are people who've had radiation, for example, for a pediatric malignancy. They used to use radiation for tinea capitis, a fungal skin infection of the scalp that led to a high incidence of brain tumors in people who were cured of their fungal skin infection. There have been increased incidences seen in people who are electrical workers, in people who have exposures to chemicals, such as farmers. But the only thing that's been seen in series after series is that exposure to ionizing radiation.
And is there a genetic component to brain cancer?
There are some kindred, some families that do have a higher propensity to develop brain tumors. Some of these are well characterized. Others of them, still geneticists are working out the details. But most commonly, it's a sporadic thing in the cohort, in the patients that will be diagnosed.
And there's also been a lot made in the lay press about these reports of an association between the use of handheld cell phones and brain cancer. And what's your sense? Is that myth, fiction, or is there some truth to that?
Well, I have to rely on the reports of epidemiologists, because obviously this is something that somebody who has used a cell phone, gosh, did they use it more on the right-hand side of their head or the left-hand side of their head? And people got brain tumors before there were cell phones, and I don't think that there's been a dramatic uptick in the incidence of brain tumors since cell phones were diagnosed, or not diagnosed, became commonly used.
Yeah, very widely used. It's really quite remarkable these days.
It's hard to believe we ever, hard to believe we didn't walk around with them without them 10 years ago.
That's right. Now, what would be some of the common symptoms that would make one suspect that perhaps there might be something going on up in the brain?
Well, the two most common general symptoms are headache or a seizure. Headaches are most commonly seen in the morning. You might be awakened with a headache or wake up in the middle of the night with a headache. And seizures, of course, are uncontrolled electrical activity in the brain that leads to loss of control or abnormal sensation. The brain, however, is a very complex computer. To draw an analogy to modern technology. And obviously, if one part of the computer isn't working right, it can affect a different part of the brain's function, so that a tumor arising in the part of the brain that's responsible for movement or coordination will affect those specific areas. One that arises in the area of the brain that's responsible for language will affect the ability to speak clearly or come up with words. So the most common thing that I think people initially might think about if they are having some of these problems is, gee, am I having a stroke or am I having some sort of a problem of that nature? And then obviously being evaluated by a physician who has a adequate level of suspicion, getting a good examination and getting imaging done to take a look at what's going on inside the head are critical to helping make the diagnosis.
And again, if anyone should have any of these symptoms that you just mentioned, headache or maybe some, you know, weakness or numbness or funny sensations, either in the arms or legs, who should they actually go and seek out medical attention first? Should it be the general internist? Should they actually go to a neurologist?
I would say the internist is probably the best gatekeeper. I think that neurologists obviously have great skill at doing a neurologic examination and may have a broader differential diagnosis. Unfortunately, most of the patients I see have brain tumors, so that when I hear hoofbeats, I think of brain tumor.
Right.
But there are lots of other conditions that can cause problems with the brain's functioning, vascular problems, problems with stress. So that I think that an internist is the first person that should be seen to try and work up a problem that you suspect may be related to a brain tumor.
And maybe that's an important point to emphasize to our listeners out there, that should you have any of the symptoms that Dr. Nisley has, you know, outlined for you, still probably the most common cause for those symptoms would be a benign cause,
right?
A non-cancer.
It's also
etiology.
Possible that if you have medications for other conditions, that they may be causing problems with, for example, your blood sugar, or you might be taking medications that are making you excessively drowsy, or you're having a bad reaction. And obviously, your internist will know what you're taking, and what might be the guilty agent.
Mm-hmm. Now, so say an individual goes to see their internist, the internist does a physical exam and finds some abnormalities. What would then be the next step in the workup process?
Well, the quickest and easiest test to get is a CAT scan. A CAT scan can be obtained in about 10 or 15 minutes' time and will show whether there is a clear abnormality evident within the brain substance, within the brain tissue. If something is seen on that, then that is frequently followed up in short order with a MRI scan. It is possible that a CAT scan won't be able to make out clearly exactly whether or not something is abnormal. And if that's the case and the systems are persisting or worsening, obviously an MRI scan as a more sensitive instrument will be able to help resolve with a greater degree of clarity exactly what's going on.
Now, one of the things that people have described is that if they're claustrophobic, that they might have difficulties getting MRI. What's your experience been with patients?
I think the apprehension is the worst thing. I think that patients can get adequate amounts of medications like Valium or Ativan or Xanax that will make them drowsy enough that they will be aware that they're having the MRI scan, but the unpleasantness or the subjective unpleasantness of being within the MRI scanner is not so bad. There are as well open MRI scanners, and those open MRI scanners are certainly very good for helping make the diagnosis. The pictures are perhaps not as clear as might be required for some interventions, like guiding a surgical biopsy, but in terms of making the diagnosis, you shouldn't let concern about having an MRI scan hinder your getting the appropriate investigations to guide your diagnostic workup.
Great. And then if, for instance, a mass, a lesion, something abnormal is seen on the MRI, a lump on either the MRI or the CAT scan, what would then be done after that?
Well, a referral to a neurosurgeon is appropriate. Obviously, we don't know necessarily what exactly it may be. There are benign causes, there are malignant causes, and obviously having any sort of a lump in your brain, particularly if it's causing symptoms for you, those things we mentioned, one of the things that will most rapidly clear things up, those symptoms, will be getting rid of that lump. And obviously neurosurgeons are very highly skilled in working in and around the brain, and they are the ones who would be able to ascertain what approach would be appropriate for taking out a brain tumor and what risks might be associated with that.
Now, how invasive is the initial biopsy of that lump?
Well, you can actually obtain a diagnostic biopsy with introduction of a needle into the brain. A small, very small hole is an incision's made in the scalp. A small hole is drilled in the skull, and then a needle the size of a pencil lead, literally, is introduced under very precise imaging guidance to the point where the tumor is, in order to be able to find out what kind of tumor it is. That is something that could even be done as an outpatient, although most patients stay in hospital overnight.
Okay. And then once a diagnosis of brain cancer, a particular kind of brain cancer, is made, how is the decision made to proceed with, you know, particular treatment?
Well, at the Yale Cancer Center, we review all biopsies in a multidisciplinary conference. We have imaging experts from neuroradiology. We have neuropathologists. We have neurosurgeons, radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, and neuro-oncologists, along with ancillary staff, social workers, research staff, to help review and chart a recommended course of action. Some of these tumors are clearly managed with a certain approach because we know that works so well. For others, there are controversies about what approach should be taken. Are the risks associated with surgery acceptable? If the patient is too frail to undergo an aggressive surgical treatment, what should be done? And sometimes there are questions about the sequencing of treatments as well. And we want to try and make sure that all points of view are considered before taking any steps that may have significant impact upon a patient's health.
Great. Well, let's talk more about the treatment strategies, the various treatment strategies, on the other side of the break. At this time, we're going to take a break for a medical minute. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we're here this evening discussing the approach and treatment of patients with brain tumors with our guest expert, Dr. Jonathan Nisley.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2009, there'll be over 62,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and about 2,400 patients will be diagnosed here in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. But when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Clinical trials are underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to newly available medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ed Chu, and I'm here in the studio this evening with Dr. Jonathan Nisley, co-director of the Yale New Haven Gamma Knife Center and a senior member of the Yale Brain Tumor Center. And before the break, Jonathan, we were talking about this multidisciplinary team that you're an integral part of that evaluates, assesses, and then gives treatment recommendations for any patient who presents with brain tumors. And maybe for those who may have missed that discussion on the earlier side of the break, maybe you could just kind of briefly review again what that multidisciplinary team does and how you go about making your recommendations.
Well, we review all the relevant information. Obviously, somebody who's examined the patient, taken a history, will provide the pertinent details of how the patient presented and other relevant medical facts. We'll review the imaging. If a biopsy has been done, we'll review that. After a biopsy has been done, if a surgery has been recommended, we'll review the larger surgical specimen, the completeness of the resection that was achieved, and a recommendation will be made subsequently about management in order to try and optimize the patient's health. The recommendations frequently involve both chemotherapy and radiation therapy after surgery is done. There are some tumors for which radiation alone is used. There are some tumors for which chemotherapy certainly plays the predominant role in managing the tumor. And knowing exactly what you're dealing with is of critical importance in order to try and optimize the management recommendations. We use different approaches for different tumors.
So, but in general, though, I guess it sounds like there are three main treatment approaches that one can take for brain cancer. Is that right?
Well, I explained to my patients that there are three ways we can treat cancer. One is surgery, which is kind of like using a paring knife and a potato. You want to make the bad spot completely, get the bad spot completely out of the potato. Chemotherapy, which you know a lot more about than I do, I think of as being a whole body treatment. And radiation treatment is a regional treatment where we can treat the area that's at highest risk of having progression of tumor. Mm-hmm. And as a regional treatment, we can treat some of the normal tissues at the same time as we're treating the tumor in a way that a surgeon may not be able to in terms of excising the lump.
But I guess in a general sense, ideally, if it's possible to remove the tumor out of the brain and then follow up with either radiation plus or minus chemo might be the optimal approach.
We certainly think that's true for brain tumors. There have not been any randomized trials where there's been a we will take out part of your brain tumor and then give you radiation or chemotherapy, or we will take out all of your brain tumor and then give you radiation chemotherapy. But there is good evidence of what we would call class 2 evidence that the more complete a resection can be achieved, the greater the likelihood of long-term durable control of a brain tumor.
Now, Jonathan, one of your specialties is the use of Gamma Knife. Maybe you can tell us what that involves.
Okay. Well, Gamma Knife is a brand name for a particular device that can focus radiation to very small volumes and give very high doses in a single treatment. I actually got into radiation oncology because I saw that with our ability to perceive exactly where a tumor was in three-dimensional space and our ability to develop radiation plans to deliver radiation more precisely to the tumor, we'd be making great advances in radiation oncology. And radiosurgery, I guess, is that taken to an extreme. Radiosurgery involves, for the most accurate treatment, the placement of a neurosurgical halo, which is a device to immobilize the head and the brain within the head. And then an imaging study or several imaging studies are done to help clarify exactly where inside the skull and where in relation to that halo or frame the tumor or tumors are located. We then use a specialized computer program that can figure out exactly how to aim radiation just at the spot we want to zap. And we go through a process of checking to make sure and making sure that everything is going to be aimed exactly where we want it to go and that there won't be any problems with delivering the treatment. We plan it all in virtual reality, and then we bring the patient in the same morning and deliver the treatment. The head frame is removed and the patient goes home. The closest experience I've had to that is going to the dentist and having some work done on a filling where you get numbed up, they attach things to your head, it's unpleasant for a few hours, and then you get up, you're a little bit sore, and you go home.
Although my sense is probably it's a little bit more painful at the dentist's office than this gamma knife procedure.
Well, we have neurosurgeons who are very skilled at the administration of the local anesthesia. The frame is obviously put on with the use of Novocaine for making sure that it's no more uncomfortable than absolutely necessary.
But with the gamma knife, it sounds like there's no direct invasion into the brain.
No cutting.
Yeah.
The gamma knife.
That's really remarkable.
Yeah. Well, the gamma knife concept was originally thought of by a neurosurgeon who, back about 50 years ago, was worried about the appropriateness of doing open operations in patients when there were no intensive care units or other ways of ensuring patient safety. And if a neurosurgeon were just going in to remove a lump, if we could destroy that lump and have the body clean it up much like a bruise or just be reabsorbed, the advantages are legion. We really think it's a great way to approach spots that shouldn't be there, keep them from becoming problems for patients.
So what would be the ideal patient for whom gamma knife would be the preferred treatment of choice?
We want to have a patient who has a relatively small spot that is relatively discreet. And by that I mean that we can see clearly where the edges of the tumor are. If the tumor's edges are beginning to infiltrate into normal brain tissue or are too close to some very important structure, we wouldn't be able to use a very high single dose of radiation. We would want to try and treat with an approach that would use smaller doses of radiation given in a repetitive fashion. The tumor, probably best if it's not more than about 3.5 centimeters in diameter. We want to try and, obviously, try and treat patients before they become too symptomatic, because if there is any swelling associated with the treatment, that the symptoms that they may have may become a bit worse. They may need to take a bit of some steroids, a medication like dexamethasone or Decadron, for a few weeks in order to try and control those symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how would you compare the side effects secondary to gamma knife as opposed to the usual radiation treatments that are given to patients?
The very focused nature of the radiosurgical treatment and the fact that normal brain cells are getting such a very small dose of radiation relative to the tumor means that the side effects are much less associated with radiosurgery. Fractionated radiation therapy, the kind of treatment that may take several weeks to deliver, includes a lot of normal tissue at the same time as the tumors are being treated. And although those normal tissues can withstand a certain amount of radiation, we know that there are side effects for those normal cells. And the fatigue and loss of appetite and hair loss, change in sense of taste that are commonly seen, for example, when we're giving radiation treatment to the brain for a tumor that could not be treated with radiosurgery, those are just about always not seen at all associated with the radiosurgery.
Wow, that's terrific.
I frequently tell people that if it were my head, I would choose radiosurgery.
Mm-hmm. Now, suppose a patient who had a diagnosis of brain cancer received the traditional radiation therapy, then unfortunately develops a recurrence in the same area where they've had radiation therapy.
Well, gamma knife can be repeated. This is something that can be done on more than one occasion. The very focal nature of this is almost like picking off something with a rifle with a scope for very precise aiming, so that if you had a spot that was treated on the left-hand side of your head and you had one that came back an inch away, the amount of radiation that was delivered an inch away is low enough with the radiosurgical procedure that we can come back and treat it again. you can have. We've had patients with, for example, brain metastases who have had metastases treated on three or four. I think the most is five occasions.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's terrific. And then, do you ever think about adding chemotherapy after someone's had, say, a gamma knife procedure? Or,
well, we think that brain metastases, well, I'm speaking here specifically about brain metastases as opposed to other types of tumors, for example, meningiomas or pituitary adenomas or acoustic neuromas or schwannomas. For brain metastases, they do not develop if you do not have, they do not develop if you have control of tumor elsewhere in the body. They spread to the brain through the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. And for all our patients, we really emphasize, if we're treating the brain, we want to have their medical oncologist doing their absolute best to try and prevent new spots from developing, and that can include going on to perhaps a different chemotherapy regimen or perhaps being enrolled in a clinical trial if the standard management hasn't been shown to be successful for that tumor.
Mm-hmm.
One of the good things I'd like to emphasize, Ed, about radiosurgery is that there's very little impact upon the ability to receive systemic chemotherapy. We are not irradiating much of the circulating blood, and the fact that this treatment can be done in a single day will mean that a patient who needs chemotherapy can resume that treatment promptly. There's no several-week delay while you receive radiation therapy and then have to recuperate before your chemotherapy can recommence.
Mm-hmm. Now, question for you, Jonathan, is we hear the term cyberknife, and is that the same or different than gamma knife?
Well, it is a tool that's able to do many of the same things. It is it was invented by somebody who actually studied with the surgeon who invented the gamma knife. Instead of the approach that the gamma knife uses, where as many as 201 radiation beams are all aimed at the tumor at one time, the CyberKnife aims one beam sequentially from many different directions. It seems to take a bit longer to do the work. I have no personal experience with using it, but it's a powerful tool. And obviously, there's things that the CyberKnife does better than the gamma knife, and there are things the gamma knife does better than the CyberKnife.
Jonathan, real quickly, it's amazing. We're nearing the end of the show, but if anyone wants to get information, access help, and get information about the Yale Brain Tumor Center, is there a contact person or number that they can get
a hold of? I'd like to give two numbers out. One is, these are both 203 area code numbers. One is the Brain Tumor Center proper, and you should ask for Betsy, and her phone number is 737-1671. If there are questions about the gamma knife, that number is 688-4040, and you should ask for Linda.
And, of course, if for further information, people can also access the Yale Cancer Center website, yalecancercenter.org.
That's an excellent resource.
Jonathan, in the last 30 seconds that we have, are there any words of wisdom that you'd like to convey to our listeners out there?
Well, I hope everybody's staying warm, and I wish everybody a happy Chinese New Year.
Well, on that note, Jonathan, I agree, and we look forward to having you come back, and hopefully maybe we can talk about some of the research that you're involved with at the Yale Brain Tumor Center.
That'd be great, Ed.
Well, you've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Jonathan Nisley, for joining me this evening. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.